Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, where it's my job to introduce you to people from the world of commercial property. We're talking with investors and thought leaders about their experiences of the commercial property world and sharing our own lessons from the last 20 years to give you practical know-how so that you can follow in their footsteps. If you've ever thought commercial could be your next step, but it just seems too confusing and opaque, then you've come to the right place. There are so many exciting opportunities in this dynamic sector, and I'm looking forward to pulling back the curtain and sharing them with you.
Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, and I'm your host, Jerry Alexander. This show is all about commercial property investing for the private investor. Whether you're just getting started or scaling up your portfolio, through interviews, tips and lessons learned along the way, we want to give you the inspiration, knowledge and confidence to enjoy this great cash flowing strategy. Welcome, Ryan. Ryan Stevens, thank you so much for joining us on the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. Great to see you.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure.
In my mind, I've been thinking I need to get somebody on the podcast who can really talk sense to us about valuations. It's something that I get asked a lot. And when I came across you actually on Clubhouse, Ryan, and listened into some of your conversations, it was clear to me that really I should be asking you to come on the podcast. So I really appreciate you joining us. And I'm hoping that we're going to go through just some more of a technical podcast, I guess, on how valuations work. And from your side of the table, what us as investors really should be thinking about in terms of valuations. I really appreciate your time on this.
Yeah, it's sometimes a bit of a dark art. And you know, the old adage, you put 10 valuers in a room and ask them a question, you'll get 11 answers. it can sometimes be a bit baffling to people.
Why don't you just give us a little bit of an insight and into the types of valuations that you do, and what sort of investors or lenders that you do that work for? Just to give people a bit of context around that.
Predominantly, it is banks, banks, building societies for secured lending, for mortgages purposes. I do other types of valuations for SIPs and SASs, divorces, probate, business breakdowns, that sort of thing, independent expert valuations. And I also do arbitration work as well, which is sort of commercial rent disputes. That's another hat I wear, as it were. But in terms of the secured lending stuff, which is effectively what we're talking about today, it's for a range of lenders, from the big boys, Lloyds, Barclays, right down to your very quite unique specialist lenders, your development lenders, your bridging types of people, and everything in between. So that can be anything from sort of traditional 25-year term mortgages through to, people who just want sort of 6 months, short-term finance. So they're the types of people, and broadly the type in terms of types of property: retail, office, industrial, developments. I do a little bit of residential, but try to steer away from it. And indeed, to be fair, it's mostly people like eServe, Countrywide, those types of people who pick up obviously the vast majority of buy-to-lets and that sort of thing, and owner occupation houses, just because they can do 4, 5, 6 jobs a day and that they're geared up for it. I'll tend to pick up a residential property when it's part of a portfolio. And there's other commercial stuff in there, and they don't want to start going to 3 and 4 different surveying practices. And also HMOs as well. I do HMOs, serviced offices, serviced accommodation, that sort of thing.
Great. This is really great. And I know certainly a good tranche of our listeners will be like, right, this is definitely going to be interesting, because all those areas you've spoken about, most people that I've spoken to that are in our audience do some of those, whether it's HMO, whether they are in resi but looking at doing commercial, or they use specialist finance and all those things. So this is really good. So just one other piece. You're based in Sheffield, is that right?
I am indeed, yeah. So geographically, I live in Sheffield. I'm born and bred in Sheffield. The patch that I cover is traditionally sort of York down to London. I try and stay east of the Pennines wherever possible, just from a point of practicality. Nothing more. Sort of taking an hour to get from here to Glossop, for example, and even then there's not much going on in Glossop. It's a sort of fairly small town village. You know, it's a good solid hour and a half, yeah. hour and three quarters to get to Manchester, for example, just okay. for the travel time. So it's not really practical.
Right. So anybody listening in Australia, that's probably off limits, right?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I had a former colleague sort of saying that he'd been asked to quote on a gold mine in Ghana. Six or 8 months ago, and we were joking about, you know, maybe a little bit out of our sphere of competence. Maybe.
Depends what method of payment they're using.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, So, circle of competence is a phrase that the RICS like to use. You know, yes. So gold mines in Ghana, not quite within my remit.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So let's get stuck in. I wanted to first of all talk through the process of what happens on your side. So. Investors, they need money for either buying a project, continuing with some development work, the valuation on resale, all these sorts of things. But of course, on the other side of the wall are these valuers who have their processes to go through to come to valuation. And a lot of people don't really understand how that works. So maybe you could start off by just telling us, when you get an instruction, which generally is from a financial institution, right? When you get that instruction, what is the process you go through to actually come to some concrete valuation?
Yeah. What the bank or lender will typically ask us in the first instance is they'll ask us for, they all ask for market value. Okay. And the RICS has a formal definition of market value. Most people don't know this, this is people who've been in the industry for a long time. A lot of brokers don't know this, but there is a formal definition of market value. And I do urge people always to go and read up and see what that definition is. I could trot it out, but it's a bit boring. But it's just a few sentences and it really does encapsulate what we are looking at in the first instance.
Okay.
The lender will then also typically ask for market rent, which again has a definition, and they'll generally always ask us for an insurance reinstatement valuation. That is a bricks and mortar. How much would it cost to rebuild the property if it were to blow up or have an aeroplane crash into it? Okay. So that they're the sort of the three sort of core valuations. Depending on the lender, they'll then ask us to do certain other types of valuation, and it depends what the lender wants. So they'll typically ask us for things what are called special assumptions. Okay, special assumptions. And that's in the RICS Red Book. It's free to download for anybody who cares to have 460-odd pages of loveliness. if you're struggling to sleep, solid read. But a special assumption is something that the RICS asks us to do. And this is where your 90-day sale period comes in, your 180-day sales period, your vacant possession valuations, okay, your gross development valuations. All these are special assumptions, okay? It's crudely phrased a departure from reality, okay? I.e., we can see what we can see in front of us on the day, and that's market value. So it might be a derelict retail unit, for example. And that's the market value that we'll give them of a derelict retail unit. The special assumption may be that it's rented out to a hypothetical tenant with a nice first floor flat above, and that's the gross development value. Okay, and some lenders may ask us for to not only provide the market value but also the GDV, the special assumption of a completed development.
Yeah.
Okay. And it depends, like I say, it depends which lender it is. Some lenders, the bigger boys, the Barclays of this world and what have you, typically speaking, will only ask us for those core three: market value, market rent, insurance, reinstatement value. That's it. Some of the more interesting lenders, and especially the development lenders, the bridging lenders, will ask us for six or seven, maybe, different valuations. And what they'll do is that they'll it's all based on their risk profile and their underwriting and their credit underwriting facilities. And they'll say, right, well, if we feel this is a relatively risky asset, or maybe if the bank are overexposed in a certain area, so if they're overexposed in retail, for example, they may limit the lending to, say, 70% of the 90-day sale price. But that's very much not our decision. That's a bank lending decision. That's their underwriting and credit team who make that decision ultimately. So what we'll do is we'll get the instruction. We'll do some basic background research beforehand, you know, so have a quick look at the planning portal, have a look at the flood maps, that sort of thing, have a look at other comparables up and down the road. And I know we're going to talk about comparables in a little bit. Go out, do the inspection, you know, photos, measurements, all that kind of jazz. And then come back and sort of effectively collate our thoughts into a report, you know, and part of the report is effectively sort of being able to talk somebody through who's obviously never been to the property. You know, the bank manager seldom goes to a property nowadays. You know, it's not like 50 years ago where, you know, the bank manager would come and have a look around and say, yeah, that's fine. You know, it looks all right. I'll give you £500,000.
Yeah.
You know, we have to talk the underwriter and the bank manager through the property and, you know, be able to describe to them what you know, what the situation is. And some of them, you know, and part of the report is points of practicality. So, for example, the flood risk, the reason we look at that and put that in there is that then more often than not dictates whether insurance is available on the property. Because if a property is in a flood zone 3, for example, then it may be very difficult to get flood risk cover. Well, if you can't get insurance, you sure as hell can't get a mortgage.
Yeah.
Or you're going to have severe restrictions put on you. And so that's telling the lender, these are things, you know, so if we do find a property in a flood zone 3, for example, we highlight that to the lender right at the top of the report and say, please make sure that adequate insurance is in place that explicitly covers flood risk. The big thing with valuations, we'll probably touch on this multiple times in this conversation, is comparables.
Yeah.
So we collate all the comparables that we can that are relevant to the subject property. Analyze them as best we can, and then apply that analysis to the subject and say, right, okay, well, you know, other comparables of retail units up and down this street or in this locality have sold for X pounds per square foot, or the investments have sold at X percent yield, and therefore, you know, we have applied this pounds per square foot or this percent yield to the subject.
Okay, so with those comparables, let's just jump into that a little bit further. Where do you get that information? Is it just from other surveyors? Are there platforms that you can use that collate that? What? And I appreciate some of them have different price points, of course.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, very much so. First and foremost, it'll be colleagues, agency colleagues, and then other agents who we know, other surveyors, other commercial agents. That's the sort of bread and butter. That's free. You know, notwithstanding sending an email or picking up the phone and saying, "Hi, Dave," you know, if you, a lot of my time post valuation, I tend to do this after I've been to the property, unless it's the guys in house who I know. I can say, "I'm going to a retail property. I don't really know much about it, but I think it's about 1,000 square foot." You can have a little bit more of an informal conversation with guys you're seeing every day. But after the valuation, I'll certainly pick up the phone to other surveyors in, let's say it's in Sheffield, because you know it's easy. So other surveyors in Sheffield, I'll know the guys who deal with retail properties. You know, there are some surveyors, some firms in Sheffield who only deal with industrial.
Yeah,
that's their entire sort of business model. So I'll ring the retail guys up. "Dave, I've got a retail property. It's on such and such street. Have you done any deals recently? Have you done any rentals? Have you sold any stuff? Blah, blah, blah." And Dave may say yes or no. And if he says no, he might say, "I haven't. But if you speak to Frank, I know Frank's just sold number 22 Acacia Avenue, you know, a couple of months ago. And I think he had quite a bit of interest." So then next thing, I'm ringing Frank. And the conversation goes round. So that's the first and foremost. And again, anyone who's listening, any of your listeners, I strongly urge you to don't pester surveyors. I mean, that's you're not going to get on anyone's good side doing that. But if you're genuinely looking at a property and you think this is good for me, pick up the phone to surveyors. I always say, and it's a bit harsh to estate agents, but we're the grown-ups in the room. Yeah, we understand how things work, how the real world works. You know, any properties that we have sold or what have you, we'll tell you the information, providing we feel you're not coming from a negative place. You know, you're not coming at it sort of trying to screw somebody over.
Yep.
You know, whereas estate agents are obviously very guarded and sort of very closed and insular. You know, surveyors, we understand the game, and so that I always recommend, you know, just fire off an email to agents and valuers to try and gauge where things are from a price point of view and maybe any other comparables. And especially prevalent if you've got a valuation coming up.
That's really interesting. I mean, we need to finish off with comparables, but just while you're talking about the agents there, what you're describing is a tight network of agents that know each other, reasonably trust each other, share information so that it keeps the mark. So you all understand where the market's at, right? And there's good value there for everybody. That's a great upside. The downside, I think, from an investor point of view is you look at that network, that tight network, and sometimes it can feel a little bit impenetrable and a little bit like, crikey, can I really talk to that group? Are they going to let me in?
An old boys club.
Yeah, and I think some people just find that whole thing quite off-putting, so they don't actually venture into there. But from what you're saying, you feel that most are, I mean, everybody's different, right? But certainly the people you deal with are quite approachable, and actually that's okay to pick up the phone and maybe start asking.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, again, don't pester people. Acknowledge that people have got jobs and deals to do. And again, just putting it bluntly, dealing with your requests for comparable information is obviously not going to earn them money. In the short term, you may come to buy a property off them, and obviously then they'll be a lot more receptive to you. I can guarantee. If you're known as an active buyer, but just drop an email, or pick up the phone and say, look, I appreciate you're busy. I'm looking at maybe buying this particular property, or I'm getting a valuation done on this property. I'm after some comparables. You know, can you help? Can you help out? I want to make sure I can sort of put a good valuation pack together. That sort of thing. But yeah, you know, obviously there's always one guy who's just perpetually grumpy and will never talk to anybody because he's just way too busy and way too important. And that's just life. You know, you're going to get that with mortgage brokers, and you're going to get that with solicitors and marketing executives. You're going to get that one person who's just rude and grumpy, as with surveyors. Okay. And you're going to catch somebody on a bad day, you know, somebody who may always usually be willing to chat your ear off for 45 minutes. You're going to catch them on a Friday afternoon because the deal's just fallen through and they're throwing plates around the office because they've just lost 40 grand on a deal that's fallen out of bed.
It's interesting though that you say that about if somebody has bought a building or is in the swim properly, they will be treated not differently, but they'll be treated more seriously because it's known they're maybe not just tire kicking.
And I've seen
some investors come into the industry and they're looking to get started and they're talking about million-pound deals straight off the bat. And I think that maybe turns some agents off, shall we say, whereas starting small sometimes allows you just to progress into that. I don't know if you agree with that.
If you've got a good business, for example, you know, if you sell widgets, and your business is absolutely booming at the minute and you're making an absolute just ungodly amount of money, then million-pound deals may be your level straight off the bat. I think the first thing with agents, certainly, you know, in my experience, having obviously been as an investor, but also, you know, being in the same office as agents, as residential estate agents, if you've got proof of funds and what have you, you know, if you've genuinely got a 40% deposit on relative to £1 million property, so if you've got 400 grand cash in the bank, then they're going to take you serious, irrespective almost of whether it's your first deal or your 500th deal.
Yes.
It's all about being able to back things up. And like you say, people hate tire kickers, and they hate people sort of saying, "Oh well, you know, I work with other investors," and because that people hear those phrases like that, "I work with other investors." It's like, what you're really telling me, mate, is you haven't got any money, and you're going to put an offer in that's going to get accepted, and then you're going to run around for 3 months messing around trying to get some funds together, and then come back and tell me you can't do it.
No, you haven't been a fly on the wall, have you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes I do that, but I don't do the last bit. I do the right. We get an offer accepted. Right, we've got to find the money now.
Yeah,
but it's chicken and egg, isn't it?
I've been in the office when agency colleagues have sort of come off the phone again after having a deal fall out of bed, and they start swearing and saying, "Oh, this person's, you know, pain in the ass," and you know, they said they could do it, and It was there, and when you chat to them, when you actually sort of break it down, you let them calm down a little bit. It's like, you know, this was that person's first deal, yeah. And they didn't have any, you know, they didn't check the proof of funds, which they probably ought to have done. But nonetheless, anyway, we digress somewhat.
We do. Let's jump back to comparables. So yeah, some tools that are out there. So, obviously, we speak to agents. That's one thing.
Yeah, speaking to agents and valuers indeed, because obviously we're the ones ultimately who by and large collate the information. So yep. You know, I'll speak to somebody at Jones Lang LaSalle and Knight Frank and CBRE and maybe half a dozen other local agents. So valuers are very good at obviously collating information. And you only need, I've found you only need one valuer who's maybe valued something similar recently, and they can have 10 good comparables.
Yeah,
because
they've done that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they happen to have done it and they've put it in a nice, orderly format, properly analyzed it. You know what I mean? So that not only agents, but valuers as well.
Okay.
So the next one, again, as a good start for 10 in terms of working up in price point is EIG. Essential Information Group, the auction website.
Yeah.
It's not too much money. You know, it's sub £1,000 a year, basically.
Yeah.
And that gets you access to all future auctions, which is obviously quite useful, but also all the sold prices up and down the country.
Yeah.
And it'll take you through. It also does a bit of an analysis, like an automated analysis. It's not perfect because it sometimes doesn't take into account, for example, where part of a property is vacant. So on the front page, when you click into a property, it'll say, you know, sold for 10% yield, or and you know, whatever, yeah. X percent net, you know, it'll give you a net and a gross yield. What it doesn't take into account is sometimes when you've got a part vacant property, and so you've got a reversionary yield as well.
Yes.
So it's just be cautious if you're doing that, just to make sure you do dig a little deeper. But nonetheless, EIG is great. It's a great start for 10. And again, by the time you've sort of looked at the catalogue, and then again emailed the auctioneer, and if the auctioneer says, oh, it was difficult to get away, and you know, we had like three viewings, and we had to postpone it twice, then you know it's going to be a hard slog to get good, you know, to get a good valuation,
yeah,
or to flip it on. If the auctioneer turns around and says, we had like 500 viewings on the first day and we had to just call things off because we had to call the police because it was that busy, then you know, actually, you're probably onto a winner.
Sounds like residential viewings.
Exactly, yeah. I sort of jest to prove a point, but yeah. You know, but EIG is a great tool. Yeah. Rightmove, maybe coming down in price point again, back to the free stuff. But Rightmove is a nice little, you know, the Rightmove has got a commercial section, obviously. Difficulty with that, as always, is it's always asking prices, not achieved prices. So from a valuer's perspective, is we can't rely on that too much. We don't place too much weight. Again, weight is a very sort of useful phrase when talking to valuers. We don't place too much weight on the asking prices. It's only transacted prices, you know, where money is exchanged hand for title deeds.
It's actually happened, yeah.
The top tier in terms of comparables, and quite frankly, it's just an exorbitant cost, is something called CoStar.
Yeah, they're international as well, aren't they? They're not just
UK-based. They are, yeah. CoStar was an English company, and then it got bought out by an American company.
Yeah.
It still trades as CoStar, although the parent, I can't remember what the parent company is called. But yeah, I mean, but the cost for that is you're talking £1,000 a month,
yeah,
broadly speaking. So it is prohibitively expensive unless, like surveyors, you're using it every single day. You know, there's other little parts of CoStar like Reala, and Shop Property. Shop Property is obviously for retail. And I think, again, I haven't looked into it for donkey's years, but I think you can, if your thing is retail property, I think you can subscribe to Shop Property in of itself.
Yeah.
And within Shop Property, there's also things like requirements lists. So, for example, Domino's Pizza are looking for 1,000 square foot units on arterial roads in these specific towns.
Yeah.
And if you've, you know, if you can find a 1,000 square foot unit in Gloucester, for example, or, you know, they sometimes even go down to certain postcodes, you know, so like S14, you know, Sheffield 14, yeah, then you could look for retail properties in that part of the world and think, well, if I can get an option on it,
yeah,
and then present it, yeah, contact Domino's and say, look, I've potentially got this property. Is it of interest to you? It's, you know, merging the two, you know, getting Domino's on a nice 10-15 year lease is going to do wonders for your valuation.
Yeah. So Cool Story, yeah, very expensive. There's one or two others, but do things like Nimbus help?
I do use Nimbus, yeah, not for comparables.
Mm-hmm.
Nimbus is very good for being able to find the comparables elsewhere and then go and do a bit of research on them.
Yeah, more depth. Yeah. Yeah.
Nimbus is also great, you know, for things like site areas and also finding out who owns other properties.
Yes.
Because you don't have to pay for the title plan. If it's owned in a limited company, the Nimbus will tell you who, you know, this piece of land or this building is owned by ABC Limited. And then you can go and investigate.
Okay. But yeah. Brilliant. All right. So that's the comparables and the process. So once you've gone through all that, you start drawing up these figures. And you mentioned earlier on about different forms of valuation. So it might be bricks and mortar, it might be fire sale and different things. And some people use titles. They say, oh, an MV1 and an MV2 and an MV3 valuation. Hmm. So just for clarity, does MV1 mean a specific type or
no,
actually it's really just a title for it?
No, that is something sort of particular to each lender.
Yes.
So each lender will just listed it in an order, yeah, and it just happens to be whatever the person typed first,
exactly,
happens to,
yes,
be MV1. So they'll say MV1 will typically be market value under the RICS definition. MV2 will possibly be your market value special assumption 90-day sale.
Yeah.
Or what's sometimes called a fire sale, not proper RICS wording, but yeah, MV3 may be 108. It's literally lender specific. So, you know, you might go to one lender and they've got MV1, 2, and 3, and that might be market value, 90-day, 180-day. And then you go to a second lender and they may have MV1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And MV2, that might be 180, straight to 100. They might not, yeah, want the 90-day sale. They may just go straight to 180-day sale. Okay? So it's literally lender-specific. So every time we get a valuation in from a client, we'll look at their instruction and their sort of terms of reference within the sort of the backbones of the instruction and say, it'll typically say, you know, we want these 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different market values or special assumptions, and we just wang them in. It's not a sort of a typical thing from RICS or from a valuer's perspective or from a firm perspective. It's what the lender client wants, okay, and that's just different across the board. And they do not marry up. They may happen to marry up. You know what I'm saying? Shawbrook and Aldermore may happen to have the same.
Yes.
Mark MV1, MV2, MV3, but that's not by design. That's just by random.
Okay, so they ask for different types of valuations, and part of the valuation is almost considering the risks that they think are important, and the value to them might be slightly different to the investor and the value to another lender, because there's different pieces of the jigsaw here. So, for instance, bricks and mortar value, the covenant of the lease, the level of the income, location,
the market value has, like I said, it has a definition, and
yes,
we always work to that definition. So we exclude special purchases.
Yeah.
Okay. Somebody who may have an inherent interest or an overriding sort of advantage in buying a particular piece of land. So they're excluded from the market value definition, but providing a market value to Shawbrook will be exactly the same as providing a market value to Barclays.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
That is the price at which we reasonably believe it would sell in the market. Given,
so if you're looking at an investment property, so there's a tenant in there, Ryan, mm-hmm, as an investor looking at a yield, where do things like covenant, income level, bricks and mortar, and these things sit?
Yeah.
In terms of I guess, influence on the value that you would eventually come to?
Obviously, location and asset type are of paramount importance always. A little sort of newsagents in a little village somewhere will always be worth less in every way, shape, and form. I was going to use Oxford Street, but I read something the other day about Oxford Street sort of being, you know, just being sort of tacky sweet shops nowadays.
And all
the local councils are going sort of crazy about it. So I won't use Oxford Street, maybe Bond Street or Regent Street, but you get my point.
They're different.
So location and type of property. So industrial at the minute is just going bananas. You know, you cannot buy an industrial property at asking price. It's just, you know, things are going 20-30% above asking price almost consistently with industrial properties. And so we as valuers obviously have a finger on the pulse in terms of what's happening locally or within any given sub-industry. So we then have to say, well, okay, location and type of property, that's first and foremost. Then, as I sort of alluded to earlier, and as a view into that, you know, if for example, the tenant is Domino's PLC, that's obviously going to be better than Joe Smith, who runs a pizzeria. The whole point being is that it's the certainty that of receiving the income. Yep. You know, if it's Domino's, for example, or certainly, I mean, Domino's run a franchise type operation. So you may do well to try and get Domino's to sign as a guarantor as opposed to just,
franchisee.
As opposed to just the franchisee. But if you've got Domino's PLC as a guarantor, then you look at that and you say, well, actually, I'm very likely to receive my rent.
Yeah.
Okay. Even if the whole operation goes belly up, I can sue the underlying tenant. They'll have the ability, not just obviously they may not have the desire, but they'll have the ability to pay me.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's just an individual, that may be somewhat difficult to extract the money out of, blood out of a stone, obviously. Then you're into the sort of the less important things. But so, for example, I did a valuation a week or so ago. It was a little takeaway unit in the Midlands and a brand new 20-year lease. And you think, great, everyone tells me that 20-year leases are the epitome of good valuations. And funnily enough, I had an understudy with me, a junior surveyor who's a graduate but not qualified. And I said to him, what's the situation here? You know, there's a bit of a test, just getting him ready for his exams. And he said, well, it's a 20-year lease. No, that's fantastic. I said, well, who's the actual tenant? And it was just a random guy, and the reality of the situation is that, a 20-year lease to Tesco is great. Yeah, because Tesco have got a 20-year business plan. And, that they'll probably still be here in 20 years' time. And they're a fundamental part of society almost. A random guy who's just literally opened his first takeaway unit, doesn't know how it's going to trade or anything like that. It may as well be a 6-month tenancy, and it's not going to make any material difference, in my opinion, and quite frankly, in most valuers' opinion, because whether it's like person A or person B in that particular circumstance isn't going to matter. If that person goes bust, if they default on the rent and make themselves bankrupt, then you're in no better or worse position, whether or not there's a 20-year lease or a 3-year lease in place anyway. You've only got a single tenant paying a single rent. And so covenant, you've got to be careful what I'm ultimately getting at. Again, as your listeners, be careful who specifically you're getting to sign the lease, and especially if it's a brand new limited company. Limited companies can fold nice and easy. Yep. You might be left with a bit of F&F to sort of send the bailiffs into, but nonetheless, if the creditors go in and the receivers, you're going to be down the pecking order. Then you're into the obviously the level of rent's important, the covenant strength, and then sort of probably the last thing that we'll talk about, just because everything else diminishes quite significantly after that, is the terms of the lease, i.e., the frequency of rent reviews, the basis on which the rent reviews are done. Is it annual RPI? Is it sort of after 3 years to market rent? Is it upward only rent review, upward only, or is it upward and downward? Is it full repairing and insuring? Is it internal repairing only? That sort of thing.
Yeah. So, Ryan, if you had two identical shops in the same street, we're just picking shops, right? Most people visualize shops. They're both the same size. They're both decorated to the same standard. One has a tenant in it, which has a 10-year lease. Let's just say it's a national brand, right? Mm-hmm. For argument's sake. The unit next door has been vacant for 4 months and the owner needs to sell it because they want to get some finance to go and do some other project, right? They've got an opportunity cost they don't want to miss out on. So what is the potential value difference between those two? One, so they're identical on the same street. One's got a strong covenant and income. The other one's got no income. The possibility of an income, but it's been sat on the market for 4 months. I know that's a difficult one because it's not, but it's just to get interesting to get what is the real difference there in that covenant and that income.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what you do first and foremost is just is a straight up capitalization of the income on the income producing asset.
Yeah.
So you'd look at, if it's a national brand, you would probably expect other trans. So if, let's pick Tesco again. It's a very big, easy example.
Yeah.
Okay. Or their smaller One Stop. So there's a sort of subsidiary of Tesco called One Stop.
That's right.
That's their convenience store brand. Yeah. It operates as One Stop, but it's Tesco PLC all the way through the line. So let's say you've got a One Stop convenience store. So you'd say, okay, well, let's look, certainly regionally, at other sales. You know, this is not a situation where you'd expect to get comparables of other One Stop investments that are sold within a quarter of a mile. Yeah, you'd happily go regionally, maybe even sort of tri-county, you know, in terms of where you're looking for a good quality convenience store. So you say, okay, well, we'll value that. And that for Tesco, you on a fairly new, good quality lease, you might be talking 5-6% yield.
Yeah.
So you got your 10 grand divided by 0.06. And that's how you do that calculate, assuming 6% is the way where you feel it is appropriate. Okay. So £10,000 divided by 0.06. That's your calculation. Right. So who's next door? So what you've got to do is say, with reasonable expectation, who would hypothetically go next door? Okay. Notwithstanding the fact that Tesco happened to be next door, is it in a parade of other small local independent retailers? Okay. Or is it the high street in a good quality city, for example, like Leeds? If you've got a couple of phone shops, a couple of other sort of other national brands, Greggs, for example, you know, those sorts of people, there's a reasonable expectation that you are going to get another national brand in there or regional brand. If it's, however, a little sort of village or maybe sort of B road, for example, then the way it's a slightly complicated answer in terms of how you do it. But what you do is you defer the income for a certain length of time from the valuation date. So you'd say, right, okay, you do something. And again, I'll say it. And if people want to go off and read what this means, they can do it and probably, you know, get bored reading it. But it's called YP, years purchase in perpetuity, deferred for X number of months. So what that means in real speak is you would say, right, let's say the rent again would be £10,000 per annum, hypothetically. So you've got an ERV, estimated rental value, of 10 grand. Instead of capitalizing that from day one and just applying a straight yield to it, okay, and again, the yield is as appropriate as we deem fit, we would say, right, well, we need to account for a certain amount of marketing period. That might be another 6 months. Okay, then we need to account for a bit of rent free to the new tenant. Well, that might be another 6 months.
Yeah.
Okay. On a rental unit of £10,000, you are as an investor, you are going to receive that £10,000, but not for a year.
Yeah.
If you bought that property today, you know, you had the world's best lawyer acting for you, and the world's second best lawyer acting for the vendor. You could acquire that property today with cash. Yeah, but you ain't going to receive that 10 grand for another year. Reasonably, because you've got 6 months marketing period and another 6 months rent free. And so what that does is it discounts on a capital level, it discounts the value of the property.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, I've done valuations where we've discounted the rent for 2 and 3 years, just because we can't see a reasonable expectation that it's going to let anytime soon.
So that's a straight, that can come straight off whatever number you've come to. So let's just say, based on the Tesco one, it's worth 167,000. So that's a 6% yield, 10 grand income.
Yeah.
So then if we look at next door, same size, same decor, we've got 10 grand of income we're not going to get because of the 12 months you've just described. But what about the assumption, or not the assumption, what about the fact that, is it likely to get a similar covenant like Tesco's next door? And do you reduce the premium because the Tesco one obviously has got a higher value just because, of, as we've said,
yes, certainly. Tesco is a nice example because it's almost an extreme example.
Yes.
In that it's top of the shops. You know, you're not going to find many operators, many businesses where the comparables for Tesco investments sell at such a low yield.
Yeah, so we might look at it and say, well, actually, the comparables for other likely stores are maybe 7 or 8%.
Exactly. And so what you'd do then is you'd say, you know, you look at your Tesco investment. So I've just done the maths very quickly. So that Tesco investment at 6% would produce a valuation of 166,000.
Yeah.
Okay. If we move the yield out to, say, 8%, okay, and I'm just flicking through my tables now because I don't carry, there's thousands of calculations in this blasted thing. If we still believe the rent would be £10,000,
yeah,
on an inferior covenant, okay, so not as good quality company who's going to ultimately occupy it, so we're going to say 8%,
yeah,
and we're going to defer that income for 1 year, very crudely, that's worth 115 grand. So we've lost 50 grand effectively.
Or if we were lucky enough to get Tesco's in, we gained 50 grand.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. If you could get someone in on day one paying £10,000, just removing the deferment of the income, it puts it up to 125 at 8%.
Yes.
So even though the quality of the covenant's not quite as good as Tesco, the fact that you can get someone in on day one adds 10 grand to the valuation.
That's really interesting. And that's why sometimes it's difficult when you're on the outside looking in, saying, why is that one selling for that price? And yet the one next door is not selling or is sold for a completely different value. And it's so much based around, well, it's based around the factors we've just spoken about. So that's been a good exercise.
Yeah. I mean, I confess that is a slightly complicated sort of, you know, that deep dive into valuations and, you know, deferment of income and all that sort of stuff. I'd recommend people go away and probably have a little bit of research into deferring, you know, deferred periods.
There are a few, and we're not going to go into it, but there are a few different ways RICS have for valuations, isn't there? And that's one of them.
This is sort of academic, you know, this is university stuff, don't get me wrong. You know, I learned this stuff at university. So it's not sort of entry level stuff that you'd probably expect to pick up on I run a valuation course and I certainly don't teach anything like deferred incomes and what have you. It's really sort of, you know, quite advanced.
I think it's really important that people understand there is actually a science behind this. There isn't just fingers in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to work out what's going on, you know. But I want to come on to the subject that's really important to me and my strategy and quite a lot of listeners too, which is multi-let buildings. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about two different types of multi-let buildings. A multi-let obviously having different, rather than just one occupant, having many occupants. But there are different types of contracts in place. But let's just take the two kind of extremes, really. One being full appearing insuring leases, where you maybe have, let's say, 20 clients in a building and they're all in full repairing insuring leases. They might be on internal repairing insuring leases, but nevertheless, they're effectively in control of their space, in charge of their space, versus the other side where you've got lots of licenses. So you might have 20 customers in on licenses. And I guess the third thing to just throw into that is actually that multi-let building being let to one occupant. It isn't multi-let, it's let to one occupant on one lease. So it would be good if you could just help us see how RICS currently view multi-let buildings and multi-let buildings with licenses.
So that third example you gave is the easiest one to start with, the single let.
Yeah.
That's as at before.
As we've done, yes.
That we just capitalize the income straight up. Okay, so moving away from that, we've done that. Leases versus licenses. It's a toughie because if you've got the exact same number of tenants, then your gut reaction is to say, well, leases are obviously going to be better. You know, if there's no differential, if the only difference is the sort of form of contract. But again, the devil's in the detail. So what do these leases actually require you to do? You know, do they have yielding up clauses? Do they have, you know, schedules of condition? Can you do scheduled dilapidations yes. at the end of them, that sort of thing? Are there rent reviews within them? And similarly, you know, and that's equally the same for the licenses. You know, just because it's a license doesn't mean you can't put rent reviews in.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. So it's who you've got. You know, and but the big thing with sort of like, you know, serviced offices and that sort of thing, again, it comes down to how likely we believe that they are to let out.
Yeah.
So if it's a brand new space that's just been, you know, just been converted or renovated or whatever, and let's say you're getting evaluations immediately, you know, on the day that the build or the day after the builders have left the building. And quite frankly, you know, again, let's use your example of 20 spaces. If you've only got four of those spaces rented out on the day of valuation, that's not the be all and end all. Because what we've got to say is, well, how much demand is there for this building on an underlying basis? Just because the builders only left yesterday and the dust is literally still settling, doesn't mean to say that this place will only ever have four out of the 20 spaces occupied. Now, it gives us a certain degree of comfort if you can wait a month or two and actually have the space full up. Because, again, part of valuation is subjective. There's no getting away from it. It's not absolute science. It's an art and a science. If you're wanting to make a valuer feel comfortable about putting a slightly lower yield on the capitalization, if the building's full, then that's a great thing. Leases versus licenses, the devil's in the detail. In reality. So how you'd go about actually valuing that type of space. So I think you're talking about flexible office space here, aren't you? Serviced offices.
Let's do that, yeah.
And that sort of thing. There's two ways of doing it. The first one is just simply take the rent, the estimated rental value. And it's much the same, but again, for people who are maybe making that transition from resi investing into commercial, it's broadly the same as either serviced accommodation in terms of, you know, traditional residential serviced accommodation or HMO valuations. Okay. Get your head around that and you're sort of 90% of the way there with serviced offices. Okay. So the one way of valuing it is saying, right, we've got a rent of £100,000 across, you know, from all these units. We'll take off a certain element percentage for voids. A certain element, depending on what the leases say, for landlords repairing obligations and maybe the landlords insuring obligations, again, depending on what the leases say.
Yeah.
And then we'll capitalize that at an appropriate yield. And again, the appropriate yield isn't made up by the valuer, it's made by the comparables. So if you're looking to invest in this sort of thing, please, 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 as investors, make sure that you know what the comparables are before you buy the property. Don't buy it and then think, oh, sugar, you know, the comparables are only at 9% and I need it to be at 8% in order to pay my investors back or in order to sort of get rid of the bridging finance. And you've gone too far at that point.
Yes.
Do the comparables before you buy the blooming project. And so that's one way to do it. Effectively is to say, right, just I'm going to get me top line turnover rate, you know, to turnover effectively the gross rent, take off some costs, take off some expenses, some voids, maybe management if appropriate, and then capitalize the net rent.
The net, yeah, okay.
That's one way of doing it. The yield on that you would expect to be higher because it's riskier. However, the other way of doing it is you say, right, you do a blend of valuation. So you do a bottom slice and a top slice. So you'd say, right, how much would this actually rent for as a single unit? Okay, let's assume it's just a one floor office space for ease of conversation. So how much would it rent for? So it might only rent for £50,000 a year to that single occupier that we talked about earlier. So effectively our third example, which we talked about first. So if it had rent out for £50,000 a year, we'd say, all right, okay, £50,000 at an appropriate yield. Now that yield's going to be lower, okay, because it's probably a bit less risky. But then you say, okay, well, what we're going to do as well is we're going to sort of add on the top slice of, let's say, another 30 grand, because let's say we've taken 20 grand off our...
Yeah, we've worked out the net income from the trading element. Yeah.
So we've got a 30 grand top slice. And what we're going to do is we're going to then cap, because this is the reality of the situation is that it is serviced officers.
Yeah. So trading,
the worst case scenario for the bank is that the serviced office operator goes bust and they've got to rent it out, you know, or sell it to a single occupier. So we've got that underlying base valuation, the top slice, the 30 grand. We can actually capitalize that at a yield effectively in between the low risk, single occupier. Yep. And the very high risk, numerous occupiers, because we've sort of accounted for that risk differential in the baseline.
Yeah.
So you may, and again, I'm just pulling numbers out the air just for the ease of the conversation. You may capitalize the 80 grand straight off the bat at 12%, and that would produce a certain valuation. I can't do that calculation off the top of my head.
So that's option one. Yep. And then so option two.
The second option would be 50 grand at, say, 8%.
Yep.
Plus 30 grand at 10%.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's really interesting, because I haven't had a valuation done that way, but I've had conversations with people about that, and I'm glad you've brought that out. Just those two different ways of doing it.
Yeah. And again, quite frankly, it would be evidence dependent.
Yes.
Okay.
So we need to look at comparables.
Yeah. Just straight up there. We can do all the tweaking and fiddling and messing around, and we can look in textbooks written by Professor so and so. The fact of the matter is what is the evidence telling us that how these things should be valued?
So, okay. In my industry, one of the most important things I say to people that are off out looking for these types of buildings, and when they're looking at others, is keep notes, because the industry is quite small, and valuers are out doing lots of different types of buildings, and they don't necessarily deal with service space all the time. So it's really important, if you're out there, is just keep gathering that information, because you just never know when you need to present it to a valuer, because that's going to make their job easier, isn't it?
I suppose, actually, now you've mentioned it, one other thing that I didn't mention, I forgot to mention earlier, when you were saying about where to get comparables from, is other investors in the specific sub-industry that you're in, if we take property as the umbrella industry, if you've got pals or colleagues or associates or what have you, people who you go to a networking event with who are also operating in the serviced office space, speak to them, because if they've had a valuation done, within that valuation, there will be comparables. Okay. Do you know why I know that? Because it's mandatory. It's mandatory under the RICS regulations for a Red Book secured lending report for comparables to be in that report.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So those comparables will be in there. And if those comparables are comparable to your property as well, i.e. does it look, feel, smell, feel the same? Is it the same sort of thing? Then their comparables can be your comparables. And so what you can do is you can say, you don't have to send me the whole blooming report. I just want page 32.
Yeah.
I just want page 32. Just send me the comps, and then I can look at that and think, well, okay, this is telling me, broadly speaking, that if I buy this property, I can expect a rent of 20 quid a square foot. And broadly speaking, I can expect a capitalization yield of 10%. And if that's the case, you can work your numbers out. You can say, okay, well, it's going to cost me 500 grand to buy the place and 200 grand to renovate it, and I'm going to get X rent capitalized at Y. Is that going to be sufficient enough? And the holy grail, obviously, is always if you're buying, renting and refurbishing and refinancing, people want to get the money back out, by and large. That's the thing that most property investors do. They want to get the deposit back out of their deposit and renovation money back out. And if you can work that out with the comparables at the front end, then you're not scratching your head and thinking, you're not having a hernia after the renovation and when the valuer comes back and, quote, downvalues it. It's, well, not that the valuer probably, possibly, I'm not saying this doesn't never happen, but they probably haven't downvalued it. What they've just not done is they've valued it properly and it hasn't met your possibly unrealistic expectations.
From where you were expecting it to go. I just have to say here, I'm really excited to say that we're going to discuss that a bit more. We're going to do another podcast, Ryan, and we're going to discuss about how to do the BRRRR strategy in commercial. So I'm looking forward to having that discussion. Just on the multi-let thing, if I could just ask you, in your experience, and I know that this might be different locations and it's comparables in other areas than I necessarily operate in, but have you got any kind of recent transactions where there's been a serviced office type offering or flexible space and you've been able to see the underlying multiple or the yield that's been expected on that? Have you got any kind of numbers on recent transactions you've seen?
Oof.
Or is that not really something you've been doing recently?
I mean, I've done some serviced offices fairly recently. Right. So it was in the Midlands, and it's best best I can offer you. They were sort of going 9.5% to 11%.
Yeah.
The comparables in that location.
A multiple of 10, really.
Yeah, that's a nice place to start. It's an unfortunately almost too easy answer to give. Yes.
And that's based on that first option of let's just roll this all in and what's the net after we take out all these different costs and things. And obviously we need to make sure we feel that the space is going to keep busy and all those sorts of things.
Yes.
But the second valuation is slightly different. And that obviously is going to be based on, I guess, more to be able to actually work out what we think that second level is. We either need really good comparables or it needs to be operating for a period of time. So actually you can see those numbers.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing to think to take into account is that the RICS Red Book requires you to value at highest and best use.
Yeah, okay.
And so if the comparables, if say some comparables are suggesting that sort of split income value valuation methodology, then that very well may be appropriate. And indeed, it may produce a higher valuation because of the underlying base layer gets valued at a lower yield.
Yes.
So just for your listeners who may not be completely over, I know we've been talking about it all podcast and a bit late in the game to be telling people, but a lower
glossary.
Yeah, all other things being equal, a lower yield will produce a higher valuation.
Yes.
On the so 10 grand at 10% yield will produce a lower valuation than 10 grand at 8%. So 10 grand at 8% is £125,000 capital value, whereas 10 grand at 10% is only £100,000 capital value.
Yeah. So it's based on, if you're actually a pure investor in the property, it's based on what interest do you want on your money, effectively? What yield do you want on your money or your return investment? Is it 10%? If it's 10%, it's a multiple of 10. If you're happy with taking 8%, it's a multiple of 12. Is it 12.5?
8's 12.5, yeah.
Yeah.
So what you've just talked about there is the YP, the year's purchase, which we were talking about earlier. The yield and the YP are the inverse of each other.
Yeah.
So you divide 1 into 100. If you divide 8% yield, so 100 divided by 8 will produce 12.5.
Yeah.
Which is the year's purchase. It's the amount of years it will take you to get your cash back.
Yeah. Okay. Right, Ryan, I feel we're getting to a point where we need to close this one off. It's been super valuable. I'm really pleased at our discussion there about multi-let buildings. We didn't have any conversation about that beforehand. I'm glad of where you came to on that. I think it's probably just important just to point out two things here for investors. Number one, I've mentioned it before, but it's probably worth just saying, when you're looking at a building, you want to get a valuation done. It's important to remember who instructs that valuation. Because if you instruct a valuer to go in and do a valuation on your behalf, when it comes to raising the finance, that initial valuation is seen as potentially a conflict because they were operating on your behalf, not on the behalf of the lender. So, Ryan, I'm assuming you agree with that, that realistically that's where the
I agree with it. The RICS agree with it, yeah. So, basically, if you've got somebody in who you know is au fait with a certain type of property, especially, I mean, obviously, if you've got a just a single industrial property, then most valuers will probably be sort of fairly happy to deal with it. If you've got something like serviced officers or something a little bit out of the ordinary, and you know there is one specific valuer in town who really knows what they're doing in that particular industry, don't have them do a valuation for you beforehand.
Yes.
Because by and large, they'll be precluded from acting for the bank. Because even though on a mortgage secured lending valuation, you pay the valuer's fee as the borrower, you are not the client. The bank is the client. Yeah. And so it's a conflict of interest to act for the borrower or you know, the it may be maybe the buyer at that point, and then go and act for the lender who's lending money to that borrower.
Indeed. So if you go out there and you find yourself somebody who really understands the language about serviced offices or shared space, flexi space, be careful. What do you want them to do for you if this is going to be a long-term relationship? Do you want them to do valuations? Do you want them to do some other activity for you? So you just got to think that through before you press the button.
Yeah, indeed.
So one last question then. Investor is, and I think I know the answer to this already through our discussion, but let's just do it. An investor comes to you and says, right, or goes to the bank, sorry, we need a valuation. What can the investor do to make your life easier, Ryan?
So, I mean, valuation packs is again, sort of something I talk about on a fairly regular basis. Mm-hmm. This is now, before I start doing this, again, as I said earlier, this isn't going to work every time with every surveyor who comes out. You know, again, you're going to find some people who feel you're treading on their toes or telling them how to suck eggs and all this sort of thing. Yeah. So don't start sending emails into Jerry saying, oh, well, I once gave a valuer a valuation pack and he didn't accept it. Well, tough luck, you know, move on. But by and large, you know, comparables are the big thing. Now, when I say, again, I'll give your listeners some homework, effectively, if they want to go and do it. There is an RICS information paper. It's comparables in real estate valuation. Okay, if they just Google, other search engines are available. If they Google RICS information paper comparables in real estate transactions, they'll come across a document. This one's only about 50 pages, so it's not going to take sort of years to read. But I do urge people to read that. It's a little bit dry, you know. Don't get me wrong; it's not an exciting read, but joking aside, it's very, very useful in terms of what a valuer needs in order to present comparables within their report, okay? And therefore, what you ought to be thinking about how to present valuers with comparables. It's not just an address and a sale price, okay? There's a lot more that goes into it than that. So read that, apply that information to what you give the valuer. So you want good, you know, effective. I always say, broadly speaking, a well-researched comparable, it should take up about half a side of A4 per comparable. You want to give them that in paper form and then in email form. Because ideally, what you want to do is lead the valuer down the garden path, lead them to the destination that you want them to arrive at by giving them well-researched, verifiable comparables. As valuers, we don't have access to all information. There's no central database for all property transactions. And we can't just go and click, click, click. There we go. That's every single piece of comparable information. Sometimes things escape us. It's a matter of fact. We only have a certain amount of time to do this. And I can tell you now, it's in your interest as an investor to make sure that we arrive at the number that you want us to arrive at. And if the evidence is there, then it's very helpful to have it given to us in a well-researched, succinct way. However, if you just give it to somebody in a paper form, then we've got to start transcribing that. That just takes forever. So if you can send it an email, as long as it's good information, you know, copy paste.
Yeah,
it works. Okay, so that's one thing. If you've renovated a property, a architect's PCC, practical completion certificate, it's a big thing in RICS. Has been for the past couple of years, especially. There was a piece of case law, Hart versus Large. Okay, top and bottom of it, the Harts were a family down south, and they took Mr. Large, a surveyor, to court because he missed something, unfortunately, and he got sued for negligence. And it was a real sort of minor technicality, but he suggested that they ought to get a practical completion certificate. He was doing a, Mr. Large was doing a building survey for the Harts in this particular case. Nonetheless, this has mushroomed in a massive fashion. So whenever you're doing a building project, you need to get a PCC, practical completion certificate, from an architect. Okay, it will cost you some money, but I can guarantee it'll be worth it, and it'll make your life as investors and developers so much easier. Okay, but Mr. Large got sued because he only recommended that they get a practical completion certificate, not that they absolutely should. So a PCC will make your life so much, because whenever I go to a property as a valuer and I'm advising the bank, I always say completely withhold funds until a PCC has been presented. Yeah. Okay. And any half competent surveyor should be doing that. And then all your other things, your EPC certificates, you know, that's become a real big thing again. You know, I always recommend getting a new EP, especially if you've renovated a property recently. It's likely that you will have increased the EPC. Spend an extra 100, 200 quid and get a new EPC done. And if that is, you know, B, C, D, it's going to be a damn sight better. And again, the valuer is going to feel more comfortable valuing at a slightly higher rate because it's future-proofed. Yep. Whereas if it's an E teetering on the edge of despair down to an F, yeah, the valuer is going to be a little bit more shy,
yeah,
and move the yield up a little bit.
I feel that's another whole podcast right there, Ryan.
Yeah.
So basically, the more information, but not ramming it in the surveyor's face or the valuer's face, being yeah. subtle about it, but gathering a professional pack is really worthwhile.
In my opinion, yeah, absolutely. You know, it helps out. We don't have oodles of time. You know, so I'll not go on a little bit of a rant, but you know, basically the fee that we charge isn't necessarily the fee that you pay. Sometimes, more often than not, in fact, borrowers pay a quite a large premium over and above what we as the ultimate value would get paid. There are lots and lots of middlemen, trust
yeah,
me,
okay.
Adding a slice on. So I'm not going to rant about it, but nonetheless, we don't have tons of time. From a fee earning perspective, but also, you know, the banks do place time restrictions on us, literally. Yeah. And so we can't just go out and spend days and days and days researching comparables exclusively. We will get a sufficient amount of comparables that sort of feels appropriate, and then move on.
Yeah,
it's just a matter of fact. I'm sorry to have to say it like as blunt as that, but if there are good comparables out there that you're aware of as an investor, and again, it's definitely worth your time doing it, because small changes in yields, as we've said before, can make massive differences.
They certainly can.
To the valuation.
All right. This has been fantastic, Ryan. I really enjoyed this. Learned a lot. You've answered some really key questions I get asked a lot. I'm pretty sure you'll have people reaching out to you. So let's just remind them that it's Sheffield plus an hour is kind of the distance.
Yeah, plus a couple of hours, yeah. But not going west. I don't like travelling west. Up and down the M1, I'm perfectly happy with.
Yeah, yeah. All Westerners appreciated, but maybe, yeah.
Yeah. It's a different valuation methodology over the Pennine.
That's right.
Yeah.
Ryan, it's been fantastic. Thank you. And we're going to come back at some point and talk about your own investing career, because this isn't just from a surveying point of view. You also sit on the other side of the table too. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation and talking about asset management and how to add value to buildings and try and get your money back out, really, investment yeah. money. So it's been super. Thanks, Ryan. I'll put
your
contact details in the show notes where people will be able to get in touch with you. So thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hi there. I hope you're enjoying the content delivered on the CPI podcast. Even though it's free to listen to, it actually takes quite a bit of time and financial commitment to deliver each and every episode. Did you know that by leaving a positive written review, you, yes, you, will have a direct impact on the visibility of the podcast? And that's really important, because by reaching a wider audience, it helps our team to continually improve the overall content that we deliver to you week after week. For some of you, leaving a review will be second nature, but for others, it might be a first one. Open your podcast app, pick the CPI podcast and search for previous reviews. And on iTunes in particular, click to look at all of the reviews, and then you'll see an option to leave a written review. Go on, it'll only take 2 minutes and it'll really make our day. And we genuinely read every single one of them.